Welcome to this special highlights program of a CME meeting we hosted during the recent GU Cancer Symposium in Orlando. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. This conference was a collaboration with the Duke University School of Medicine and was co-chaired by Dan George. For this program, we asked four practicing oncologists to present cases of advanced prostate cancer from their practices to our faculty of Drs. Phil Kantoff, Steve Freeland, Oliver Sarter, and William O. The case presenters were Drs. Andrew Armstrong and Manjesh Ligamurthy, and coming into the conference by Skype, Drs. Philip Glynn and Eric Rupard. To begin, Dr. Armstrong presents a patient with one of the most challenging situations in oncology, PSA-only relapse.
So this man had clinically localized low-risk prostate cancer. In fact, you could probably argue back then that he was in the very low-risk NCCN category, and he received iodine-125 brachytherapy, and he was one of the rare group of men to fail that therapy and developed a PSA recurrence. His doubling time over the next 4 years started to accelerate, and the most recent calculation using the last three values was about 9 months in terms of doubling time, and his absolute PSA currently is about 8.7. He's been staged at the CT and a bone scan, and one of the questions that comes up has been around the prostacent.
So you told me that actually it was the urologist who ordered the prostacent scan. Right?
Correct.
Okay, so what's this man's attitude? Is he, you know, the kind of person who wants treatment done as soon as possible? He's, you know, plotting his PSAs or just sort of leave me alone?
Actually, he doesn't ask a lot of questions. He says, whatever you think, doc.
So, Steve, how would you be thinking through this man's situation and would you initiate treatment?
So you have the classic data in terms of PSA recurrence after surgery. This is a patient after brachytherapy. And 9 month doubling time was kind of a cutoff in terms of particularly poor outcome under 9 months. Above 9 months tends to be better. He's 60 years old, I presume reasonably healthy.
He has hypertension and he's obese.
Okay. That's pretty healthy for North Carolina. It's like most of the patients I see. So he's probably not dying of his comorbidities in the next 10 to 15 years. You know, this is one of the problems we see with radiation failures is his PSA is 6 points higher than his nadir. Recurrence definition is nadir plus two. We tend to see delayed treatment of recurrences after radiation. There was a session on that nicely. And that's one of the things after surgery, they tend to be treated earlier.
Can I just clarify that? Because I'm not sure I've heard that before. So is the PSA, the implications of PSA doubling time different in somebody who had primary radiation treatment?
There's not great data comparing them. You know, D'Amico's done some really nice stuff after radiation. Doubling time less than 3 months is really bad. We see the exact same curves for surgery. The 3 to 9 month, the teasing out that we did here, I've not seen that with radiation. But there's no reason to think that it would be particularly different. So I tend to use the same kind of approach to that. And to me, I think in translating to the surgery patients, if you have a surgery patient who has a very short doubling time post-surgery and you radiate him, his PSA usually comes down. So I think we need to be careful of saying 9 month doubling time, 6 month, even a 3 month doubling time equals metastatic disease. I think it's high risk for metastatic disease in the absence of treatment. But in this patient, I think we need to think local first. I think he's had brachy. I think you biopsy him and look. Consider whether you do external beam, add it on, talk to the radiation. Would you consider him for salvage prostatectomy? I would not do it, but the Memorial Group and Mayo groups are doing that. So I think you need to think local first.
So bottom line is he's saying, doc, you know, just tell me, what do I do? What does he do?
I think we biopsy him, see if there's local recurrence, and if there is, I send him to our radiation oncologist for consideration of external beam.
So he goes down
or cryo,
the hall
or
and
cryo.
Gets an opinion from your colleague, Dan. Agree or disagree?
Well, you know, this is why we do a multidisciplinary clinic at Duke.
Exactly.
So that we can educate the urologists as well as the patients regarding management of these folks. So the key thing here, this guy never achieved a PSA nadir less than one. So those patients have very rapid relapse. And in general, I would say this may be a patient who was perhaps undergraded by his disease. Perhaps if we actually had done a prostatectomy on him, we might have seen more high-grade disease. He was young, but he had a PSA of over 10. We don't know how quickly that PSA was rising going into this. This patient may have more aggressive disease than he was originally appreciated for. And with that sort of non-responsive result to his initial local therapy, I'd be thinking more microscopic metastatic disease.
But Dan, it looks like his PSA is Gleason 6 in multiple cores.
Yeah.
His extensive metastatic disease is negative. His MRI does not show extracapsular extension.
How about we get into like what you do? So I'm going to ask but first, Dan, exactly what would you do?
So in a guy like this, first of all, I mean, I'd reassure him. I mean, I think Steve's data, I think there's data similar to Steve's data with the radiation population that shows similar results with a relatively long survival for their patient like this. We know in the last 10 years, Neil, how much this field has changed for advanced disease. In the next 15 years, we think it's going to change even more. This is a gentleman who, even though he's 60, I think he's going to live for a long time with this disease. So I think we don't have to panic, number one. Number two, I think this is a moving target following his PSA doubling time. And if it's accelerating faster now, it's starting to increase on that curve, then I'm going to be thinking about initiating hormonal therapy sooner rather than later. If, on the other hand, this is still hanging around that range, you know, I'm comfortable watching it.
So, Phil, what do you think? You want to choose between Steve and Dan or somewhere in between?
You know, 60 is looking younger and younger to me. So, this is a guy with a 20-25-year life expectancy. He will die of prostate cancer if he's not cured. I agree with you, the likelihood of being cured is not high, but this is a guy who came into this situation with good risk disease, as I understand. He had a Gleason 6. Yes, indeed, he may have been undergraded, but I would like to know, is this man still curable? I think the chance is low, but I want to give him the benefit of the doubt, and I would go out of my way to prove to myself that I could not try to cure him with further local therapy.
How do you like Steve's idea of a biopsy?
Well, first thing I would do is an extensive metastatic workup. Prostacin I don't really do. I don't think it's terribly useful. But MRI, bone scan, and...
MRI of what?
MRI of the pelvis, a bone scan. And if those two things are negative, I would do an extensive biopsy. I would ask my urologist to do an extensive biopsy of the prostate, map out the prostate. If low-grade Gleason 6 prostate cancer is found in the gland, I would have said the seeds did not treat the prostate. You have a chance of curing this disease, and I would give him the benefit of the doubt and treat him locally.
I see some head nodding in agreement. Steve?
I would agree in general that, you know, a shorter doubling time is more worrisome, more likely to be metastatic disease, but I think I agree with Phil that this guy deserves a chance, albeit a low chance, but a chance at cure. And, you know, the one other point I would make to him that Andy actually brought up is the guy is obese. I would talk to him about lifestyle interventions, weight loss. There's actually a paper that just came out in the Journal of Clinical Oncology that actually showed more than 3 hours a week of vigorous exercise. It was really specifically vigorous exercise. More than 3 hours a week, you were less likely to die of prostate cancer. Any exercise was associated with lower all-cause mortality, but for prostate, it was specifically 3 hours a week of vigorous exercise.
What's this man's exercise pattern, and how obese is he?
His exercise involves getting up to turn off the TV.
So, actually,
he used to do
Steve,
it really fast.
there were three papers presented at the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium correlating the presence of obesity with recurrence. What about obesity aside from exercise? And what about the meal study? I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, so, I mean, obesity in prostate cancer has clearly been shown to be associated with a bad thing. We showed it was associated with PSA recurrence after surgery 7-8 years ago. That's been replicated in multiple studies. The MEAL study is a very interesting study. It's basically for men on active surveillance run by Kelly Parsons out in San Diego. It's now opened up as a CLGB trial. And basically, it's looking, can a telephone-based intervention for diet help slow the progression. I think the concept is great. The MEAL study itself is focused on a fruit and vegetable intake. In my personal opinion, I think that's good, but you need weight loss. And this is not a weight loss study. You really need to get them to lose weight. And there's good animal data that regardless of how you achieve the weight loss, whether it's Atkins or Ornish or starvation, however you want to do it, weight loss is slowing tumor growth in mice. So bariatric surgery, perhaps, if you're severely obese.
Dan,
weight loss.
How about pomegranate extract? I guess it was just presented here. I don't, did anybody see that? Or
it's negative.
No, it was negative. It doesn't work. I don't know.
It's great in a martini.
Yeah. What was the thinking behind it, that there's some substance in pomegranate? Anybody know about that, Steve?
I can answer this. So, I mean, the idea that pomegranate is anti-inflammatory, it actually turns off NF-kappa-B. I mean, there are many mechanisms. It works very nicely in mice. There was a single-arm phase one study that showed it lengthened doubling times. This was two doses of pomegranate in men with PSA recurrence. Both arms showed lengthening of PSA doubling time, no difference between low dose and high dose. About 65% of men had a lengthening of their doubling time, which, while sounding very, very nice, there's actually randomized trial data that show placebo-based men, 70% of their time, lengthen doubling times under similar strategies. So to me, unfortunately, the conclusion is this is placebo.
So Steve's the only renaissance urologist. I love working with Steve. William?
Well, just to follow up, that study was led by Phil and Matthew Smith at the Dana-Farber.
We had two studies,
one with rosiglitazone, the other with celecoxib, in these rising PSA patients. And basically, the bottom line message is that a quarter of the patients will double their doubling time with a placebo. So what it really means is that, unfortunately, this study did not answer that question because there was no dose effect. Both arms of this randomized study, the pomegranate extract study, both got different doses of pomegranate extract, but there was no placebo. So the fact that a significant proportion of the patients, their PSA doubling time lengthened, may not mean anything. We know that it's very problematic in a study like this to measure the PSAs going into the study and then while they're on study.
So Oliver, is this like an anti-apoptotic effect or CMET? Or I'm just kidding. But really, how would it work if it does work?
You know, I'm pretty clueless. I'm not sure that it does. But, you know, I wanted to go back to Phil's study because, you know, I remember there was one of these like non-steroidal studies, and it was way back in
Celebrex.
It's not that old.
No. This was even before that. It was some derivative.
Exasulin.
Thank you. I remember getting excited about it because, you know, all these doubling times were going out and everything, and I was thinking, you know, this is pretty cool stuff. And then, you know, Phil, who was smarter than the rest of us, decided to go in and start doing these randomized studies. And then I saw the placebo. And then my heart sunk because I realized that when you look at these type of studies and you don't control them with placebo, you may get led astray. So I'm still a skeptic, and I love Mike Carducci. I think he's a wonderful guy. But you got to control these studies in order for me to draw any conclusions.
Okay, let's go to Eric now for the next case. And again, with each one of these cases, we're going to try to focus on one aspect. Now, this is a young patient who had asymptomatic bone metastases and one of the few patients who received immunotherapy for his treatment. Eric, can you talk a little bit about what happened and what prompted you to want to treat him with immunotherapy, cipulucel T?
Sure. This was a 49-year-old gentleman, a Desert Storm veteran. In 2007, he went for his annual VA physical and was noted to have an enlarged prostate, elevated PSA. They biopsied him, found Gleason 8 disease, and he went to radical prostatectomy at that time. He presented in 2008, had mets to his femur, treated with XRT, and for the next couple of years was treated with androgen deprivation therapy with intermittent anti-androgen therapy. And finally, at the beginning of 2010, ketoconazole, of course, with his PSA going down to 10, but slowly rose throughout 2010. And in October 2010, we referred him for cipulucel T treatment, which he received in November.
So you didn't have that available at your location? He had to travel to get that?
Yeah, he traveled up to Atlanta to Emory and received it there about 2.5 hours away.
And any side effects or what happened with him?
No. The only thing that he complained of was the drive. He had to go up there 5 times. Altogether, but really nothing. He had no issues with it at all.
Okay, so I want Phil to talk in a second about this strategy and how this patient, and we're going to ask Eric for some follow-up in a second. But first, out of the blue, Eric sent me a picture of this man, Oliver. And if we can just show this as a result of his prior endocrine treatments, you can see this man has horrendous gynecomastia. And I guess, actually, Eric, does he have pain in his breasts, or is this asymptomatic?
No, he does. I think the biggest pain is emotional pain for this guy. This is his chief complaint by far, but he does also have tenderness in the breast.
So, Oliver, any thoughts about this? What do you do in this kind of situation?
You know, this is undoubtedly distressing. You know, the question is in part why. The number of patients on traditional androgen blockade who develop this degree of gynecomastia is rare. And I'll say that there are two things that are potentially doable at this point. Number one is that you can actually put these people through an aromatase inhibitor and you can help alleviate some of the tenderness, if there is tenderness associated with it. The other thing is, and I've done this on rare occasions, talk to the guy and see if he wants to get a reduction mammoplasty.
How much morbidity, Steve, is it to have this taken care of surgically?
I mean, there's definite morbidity, but I mean, I think patients do reasonably well from it. I don't have an extensive experience because usually it doesn't get to this. And I think the key message to me is prevention. And, you know, if you're going to be on a therapy and the patient starts to have problems, radiation, usually 10 gray, can be given as one session or over two sessions, is pretty good at preventing this.
How about tamoxifen?
Tamoxifen can work. Whether that interferes with some of the effectiveness of the hormonal therapy is not clear. So in randomized trials, tamoxifen works better, but radiation may be safer.
So let's get back to the cipulucyl tea that this man received. Phil, can you discuss the mechanism of action of this unique agent?
So the presumed mechanism of activity, and there was a fusion antigen between acid phosphatase and GM-CSF, and what's done is exposing antigen-presenting cells to that fusion antigen. Those antigen-presenting cells take up the fusion antigen, which in turn activates them, and those activated antigen-presenting cells are then infused back into the patient, where presumably they activate in turn T cells, and it's those T cells that are antigen-specific that are the effector cells of a dendritic vaccine like cipulucyl T. So this is just the protocol that's used, which dates back to the early studies of cipulucyl T. It involves first a leukapheresis of the patient on day one. The cells are then sent to a central processing area where the cells are cleaned and purified and then exposed to the fusion antigen in vitro, incubated for a period of time. Then the cells that are prepared, now activated, are shipped back to the physician, and the physician then infuses the cells back into the patient. And that process is repeated a total of 3 times, 2 weeks apart, a 4-week period of time.
What about the clinical trial results you reported in the New England Journal, Phil?
Right, so the big news here, which really confirmed the earlier study that was conducted by Eric Small and many others, confirmed the finding of approximately a 4.1-month median survival difference in favor of the cipulucyl T arm at 3 years. There was about a 38% improvement in overall survival associated with the use of cipulucyl T. There were very, very few PSA responses, getting back to Dan's point about what does PSA response mean, and there are a number of other drugs that are very interesting that have a lot of activity that are not showing PSA responses. And interestingly, and similar to the previous study with cipulucyl T, there was no difference in time to objective disease progression, or the time, in reality, that was the time to first evidence of objective radiographic disease progression. So those were the big findings in the study.
So, of course, the big debate, and when you were at the investigator think tank where we had 8 investigators, was how do you get an improvement in survival when the progression-free survival wasn't improved?
Right. I have to believe that there is a delay in progression. It's just we are not able to measure it. What we're measuring is the time to first progression, which occurs in a few months, and presumably the vaccine may take a longer period of time than that time to first progression, and we're not measuring the differences beyond the time to first progression. Also, as you've heard, our measurements of response, our measurements of progression in this disease are actually very, very poor. So there has been a lot of disconnect, Neil, in this disease between progression and survival working both ways. And this is just another example of this disconnect between progression and overall survival.
And there are so many instances in all these tumors where we see these kinds of disconnects. I want to go to Dan in a second, talk about the poster he just presented at this meeting, which I think is really interesting. But just one more point in terms of side effects. Now, this patient was a Desert Storm veteran. You know, he might not have complained as much as other people. Quote, no problems at all. In general, what do you see clinically, and right, what did you report?
So we're treating now about 5 new patients a week at our center, and we haven't seen anything really dramatic, but we do see occasionally patients who develop the side effects that you see here, which are chills, fevers, rarely headaches, flu-like illnesses, but very self-limited time-wise, treated with Tylenol effectively. but really, really minor stuff.
William?
Neil, I just wanted to bring up that it's important for the patients to understand that progression question. We debate the medical implications of how you get survival benefit without a progression-free survival benefit, but you know, when you're a referring physician, it's very important for them to have expectations that are realistic to the fact that their cancer may actually progress within a few weeks or months of actually completing treatment.
Absolutely. I think that's
and
a great point.
And actually, we're going to hear what happened to this patient, and actually, Eric wants a little feedback on what to do right now. But before we do, Dan, we saw before this meeting, you know, we couldn't squeeze out of you exactly what you were presenting, but we saw that you had a poster, and when I actually read it, it was, wow, interesting. So what did you present here?
Yeah, thanks, Neil. You know, I think for the purposes of time, I think Phil kind of simplified the trial designs for these randomized controlled trials with Cipulucil T. But the reality was this was in a time where, you know, this was somewhat of a novel design where patients were randomized 2-to-1 to the therapy, the Cipulucil T, or a control arm, which was made up of a leukapheresis in these patients that was then frozen. 2/3 of that product was frozen and stored away, and 1/3 of it was unmanipulated and then infused back into the patient. So that was the control arm in these patients. For those control patients, that 1/3 of the population, at the time of progression then, they were given the option to actually go on to future treatment with that frozen product that was stored. So those 3 leukapheresis products could then be used to create a new therapy, a new, what we termed a frozen product at the time.
So it's kind of like crossover.
It's kind of like a crossover. It's not exactly the same product, but it's a related product to that. So one of the sort of outstanding questions that's been out there is what happened to those patients? Was there any effect, good or bad, associated with that product? So with this analysis, we shed some light onto those patients and their natural history. So essentially, in a nutshell, what we're able to show is that about 2/3 of the patients went on to that frozen product, and those patients were actually associated with a longer survival from progression than the patients who didn't get that product. Now, this was not a randomization. This was physician and patient selected. So there's, you know, potentially some biases in there, and there were certainly differences in their prognostic profiles between there. We did some modeling in order to try to control for as much as we could that prognostic value and still saw a trend in favor of the frozen product. But, you know, this is not, again, this is not something we can conclude one way or the other. But in addition to seeing that trend, we also saw immune stimulation associated with this cryopreserved product. And we saw some toxicity more modest than Cipulucil T, but in line with that.
Like what?
The same type of toxicity, fever, chills, back pain, et cetera, but just a lower incidence. So all in all, it sort of gave the impression that there was some activity with this. But to what extent that was clinically important, we don't know. All we can say is there wasn't any apparent detriment associated with that arm of therapy.
So I thought that was fascinating. But Oliver, I want you to comment on what oncologists told us. And this was actually just a few months ago that we did a national survey of oncologists. And first we asked them, do you have access to Cipulucil T? 70% yes, but 30% no. Most of the people who have access have hooked up with tertiary centers. And I guess, Phil, that's the reality right now. You can't get this in every single sort of city in the United States. So some of these, as Eric's patient, had to travel. Which patients would you consider for treatment? So interestingly, some of the docs said they would consider either PSA progression, 28%, or in somebody who had symptoms. And supposedly the indication's only asymptomatic. What do you think about these responses from oncologists, Oliver?
Okay, so two parts. Number one, access. You know, it turns out that right now the manufacturing is pretty much in Newark, New Jersey, and you have to fly the cells in. So if you're living somewhere in kind of central Mississippi, you probably do not have access. There were also issues with regard to insurance coverage. Different regions in the country did not adopt all at the same time consistent insurance coverage, and that provided actually to Louisiana, Mississippi, and Arkansas delays in access to therapy. So there's a legitimate reason why some people would say, no, we didn't have access. Otherwise, you just refer somebody into a center. Now, you send people into Boston, and that's fine, or into Dallas, that's fine, or Houston. But not everybody has that access simply because of the logistics of travel. Secondly, the way the indications are set, and in my personal experience, the insurance companies are watching the label pretty carefully. So what they want is not the patient with a PSA-only recurrent disease. They want asymptomatic or minimally symptomatic patients with castrate-resistant and metastatic disease, and you have to fill the whole profile. So that's my personal experience. I'd love to hear from others who may...
What about putting sort of reimbursement issues aside, because a lot of times we try to sort of think theoretically in terms of risk. Certainly oncologists are used to doing this. So William, again, what do you think about the way oncologists say they're going to use or they think they're going to use it? And also, another question we had is, how are you going to sequence it? And most commonly, they say they're going to give it and then just go ahead and give chemo on progression. But others, there's a spectrum of how people respond. You know, sort of putting aside whether you can get it covered by insurance, William, sort of at a gut, you know, sort of patient level, where do you think this agent should be used?
Right. Just as a reminder, it was approved for asymptomatic, but also minimally symptomatic.
Right,
so
right.
I want to remind everyone of that. And also, as a reminder, chemotherapy use was not a requirement or an exclusion from the study. So a proportion of patients on the study, in fact, did have chemotherapy, but not everyone. So in terms of the way I would think of the use of this drug for most of my patients, it would generally be asymptomatic or minimally symptomatic metastatic castration-resistant patients or those who are not yet receiving chemotherapy. So that's the timetable where I would normally offer a treatment like Cipu-Lucel-T. Now, if they started to become symptomatic quickly, then I would be more concerned about starting something that may not delay their progression. And in that situation, you could give them chemotherapy and subsequently offer Cipu-Lucel-T afterwards.
So we're going to come back to Eric in a second. I want him to very briefly describe what's going on with this patient right now, because Phil, there's also this question of, do you just go ahead and start chemo once it's done? Do you wait for the PSA to go up? Maybe we can go back to Eric. Eric, if you could just very briefly summarize what happened since he got the Cipu-Lucel-T a few months ago and where he is right now, and let's see what the faculty maybe would recommend to you.
So his PSA was 8 at the time that he got the Cipu-Lucel-T. I saw him in December. It rose to about 18 then, and then just saw him last week, and he was up to 40. Still entirely asymptomatic, but he is understandably a bit nervous.
So how do you think he would feel about receiving chemo? Is he the kind of patient is, you know, just whatever you can do to keep things going, or, you know, I don't want to get sick, or in between, or what?
You know, he's becoming a little more aware of his disease and of his own mortality, so I think it's something that he would certainly consider. He hadn't been the kind to take any treatments before that caused him any symptoms at all, but he's moving in that direction.
So, Dan, what would you be thinking at this point for this man? His PSA is going up after the Cipu-Lucel-T. What would you be thinking about in terms of the next step and when?
That's a great question. You know, I think this is something we're going to struggle with a little bit as we go forward, is what's the right time following an immunotherapy like Cipu-Lucel-T to start with another treatment if there's not a clear indication, a clear symptomatic indication. Certainly, I mentioned PSA is something we follow, but we're not solely relying on that. So this is somebody who I would also do a re-imaging of. I'd get a new bone scan, a new CAT scan. If I saw new bone mets, that would be one of the other indications. If I saw a drop in his hemoglobin, some evidence that there was some indication there's some onset of anemia. If I saw even mild pain, you know, sometimes when we talk to patients about pain, you know, they kind of minimize this symptom. I think the first case was sort of like that. The reality is that pain in prostate cancer isn't necessarily extremely severe to be real. It can be mild pain but still be real. So to me, you know, sometimes we underestimate the sort of early onset of symptoms or the indolent onset of symptoms. So with that kind of picture in line, I have a relatively low threshold in somebody like this to move on to docetaxel chemotherapy, with the thinking that no longer is docetaxel chemotherapy our last line of defense. Now we have therapies that have been proven to prolong survival following docetaxel chemotherapy. We want to be able to have patients with good performance status following docetaxel chemotherapy so they can maximize the benefit to those treatments as well.
So just to pin you down just a little tiny bit more to help Eric out here, of course you want to see the patient and et cetera, but based on what you've heard, do you think it's like time for docetaxel now or maybe wait a little bit?
I think it's probably time now.
Eric, what are you thinking?
Well, I have one question. Would giving chemotherapy after the Cipu-Lucel modulate or decrease its effect at all?
And Phil, I'll add another question. If for some reason the patient's going to get corticosteroids, does that
right.
sort of mess things
yeah.
up?
Well, he was on ketoconazole before, and assuming he was on steroids at the same time.
He was.
So on the trial, people had to have been off steroids for a month before starting cipolucel T. I think the question of when to start chemotherapy and what the impact of chemotherapy has on cipolucel T is a completely unanswered question. And I think you have to be guided by clinical judgment here with regard to the patient symptoms. I, Dan, have a slightly higher threshold than you're shaking your head.
Well, I know your bar is higher than mine.
My bar is slightly higher. So I'm looking for other kinds of therapies that I could intervene with before I move on to chemotherapy. Admittedly, this man is progressing quite quickly and may need chemotherapy very soon.
So before we go on to the next case, which is Andy's, just real quick, William, take a look at the audience. We pretty much presented him when he got the cipolucel T, and only about half of the audience said that that's what they would do in that situation. Some chemotherapy with docetaxel and some observation. Then we throw in mild to moderate bone pain, and the audience flips over very quickly to chemo in the form of docetaxel. Oliver, agree or disagree?
You know, I agree because, you know, when you're working with these patients on cipolucel T, you know that they are going to have progression. I mean, the response rate was only about 1%. PFS was only about 12, 14 weeks. So this guy is already starting to be symptomatic. And at that point, I'm thinking we've got to get this thing under control because if we don't, these guys can get out of control. And so I'm pretty much thinking like the majority of the audience here.
So we're actually going to go on to Andy's case of a 67-year-old man treated a couple years ago for a high-risk tumor who then developed Mets. And Andy, I guess this man got a variety of treatments pretty quickly.
So this man progressed very quickly despite combined androgen blockade, androgen synthesis inhibition with ketoconazole, DES. He got cipolucel T, progressed. He got an experimental kind of Duke-manufactured vaccine. So he was not doing well.
And when you initiated the cabazitaxel, when was that?
This was about 6 months ago.
And what was his clinical situation? Did he have symptoms from the disease?
At this point, he was on OxyContin 30 twice a day. He was having pain in his hips. He was still highly functional. He had moved closer to Duke to be closer to some clinical trials because of all these things that we'd put him through. He was still otherwise very healthy, very few other comorbidities.
And what was his lifestyle like? What was he doing?
He was still active. He had a very supportive spouse. He was having pain in his hips, though. He was really looking to get off of the narcotics.
So maybe you can just briefly tell us what happened.
So at this point, his PSA was 900, quite high. And we initiated cabazitaxel, which is a novel taxane. And he was on the every 3 week regimen. He had been on prednisone very reluctantly because of all the immunotherapy that he had received. Finally, you know, because of the symptoms, we started with the cabazitaxel at the same time. We were continuing the GnRH agonist therapy. As of the last 2 weeks, his PSA is down to about 100. Interestingly, he's had a narcotic withdrawal syndrome because of his pain response, and so we've had to kind of work with him to get off of the narcotics very slowly. He's had a pretty good pain response, which is not common with cabazitaxel. It's probably about 10 or 20%.
So is he currently receiving pain medication?
Yeah, he's on just an oxycodone as needed now. So no long-acting narcotic. And he's doing reasonably well. He's still on the systemic therapies on cycle 7 or 8 now.
So, William, is this atypical? Typically, you know, a lot of times you ask people to present cases, you present the patient who does the best. But how typical or atypical is this story?
Well, I think what's remarkable about this patient is how rapidly he progressed, how many therapies he went through, both hormonal and chemotherapy. And the fact that he's responding to cabazitaxel, I think, is a fairly strong indication that this drug is not really the same as docetaxel, which is one of the concerns that had been brought up when the studies were first presented.
I mean, have you seen patients, you know, come off narcotics like this patient?
I have. I also have an excellent responder. But, you know, it's early days with this drug. You know, it was just approved less than 6 months ago, and the patients are just coming into this from docetaxel failure. But I think that I've had patients who haven't responded as well. So I think what's remarkable about this person is that he was so heavily pretreated in such a narrow window, but seems to be having an outstanding benefit to this drug.
Dan?
Yeah, just one comment, and Oliver can follow up on this. But, you know, this is actually pretty typical for the TROPiC study. I mean, the median number of treatments was 7 treatments on that study, and most of the patients had a 0 or 1 performance status. And I think that's really the key here for this drug, is that if you take patients that have a relatively good performance status, they can tolerate and do well on this therapy. If you wait until people are really performance status 2, they're not going to benefit nearly as well.
So maybe, Oliver, you're one of the investigators on the TROPiCS study that actually showed what the effect of this is. Can you talk a little bit about the study, but also about the drug itself in terms of how it works, and is it different than the other taxanes?
Yeah, you know, it is different, but I'm not sure we fully understand how. You have on the slide that the PGP drug Efflux pump was maybe implicated, and that's true, but maybe not true, because yes, it's true that it's not as good a substrate, it doesn't get pumped out of the cell quite as much, but yet the whole PGP sort of story is not held up very well over the years, so if I implicate that as a mechanism, I'm not really sure if that's the only thing going on. What I can say is empirically, in a whole variety of animal models, that you could take taxane-resistant cells and you could put on the cabazitaxel and you could continue to kill the cells even when the docetaxel taxol didn't work. And when they came into the phase 1 trials, they noted some activity, and then boom, straight into phase 3. You know, this is a stealth agent. I mean, this thing never had a phase 2 in castrate-resistant prostate cancer. It went straight to phase 3. And, you know, the primary endpoint was survival. They hit it. 12.7 versus 15.1 months, hazard ratio 0.7, good p-value. And actually, I think the median may be a little bit deceptive because when you go beyond the median, the curves are kind of split out a bit. The median PFS is also potentially a little bit deceptive because of a composite endpoint. It was kind of unconfirmed. We weren't using the working group to sort of confirm the bone scan progression. So everything came across pretty early. PSA response rate, minus antrones, 17, about what we were expecting. About double that and a little more in cabazitaxel prednisone. But, you know, the main thing is like almost every agent we use is a lot of heterogeneity. And I've been surprised in some of the patients about how well it worked, and I think I'd probably be surprised in this particular patient. I mean, he's pretty sick. He's seen a lot of different therapies in a short period of time, and then all of a sudden, boom, he's doing better than expected. And then, of course, you know, I can tell you the anecdote about the patient who's doing worse than expected, too. Dan's point was very well made, and that is, you know, we don't expect a lot of Lazarus effects. If you got a guy who's sort of getting down and out and already got an ECOG 2-3, this is probably not what you want to do. Think about this in your ECOG 0-1 patient, and there I think you're going to have some pretty good benefit, but if you wait too long, you know, you're not going to get them out of bed and make them go run around the block again.
William, what about myelosuppression using growth factors? When do you use them?
Well, in the study, there was no prophylactic growth factor use. It was 8% rate of febrile neutropenia compared to 1%. And I think, you know, that's starting to get to a rate, especially in these older men. And remember, these are highly selected, well-performing patients who go on trial. So in an average community practice, in an older group of patients, I think that's a concern enough that even though outside of the trial it wasn't used prophylactically, I generally would recommend in any patient who's over the age of 65 to consider using prophylactic G-CSF.
But not under 65?
Under 65, I think the general goal would be to look at their other risk factors per the ASCO guidelines. You know, I think the threshold should be very low to consider use of prophylactic growth factor.
So, Phil, actually, one of the most common, you know, oncologists are always trying to think ahead, you know, how can they get a little bit of advantage to their patient? And one of the most common questions we've got is, what about the sequence of this agent and docetaxel? They hear this story and they, you know, a lot of them say, well, why can't we use it first? Where do you think things are heading? I guess they're going to be compared. Are there situations, Phil, where you might use it before docetaxel?
I can't imagine using it first yet. So I think I agree with the 84%. There is a trial, which is actually mandated by the FDA, that's comparing two different doses of cabazitaxel, 25 milligrams per meter squared and 20 milligrams per meter squared, versus docetaxel, with the endpoint being cabazitaxel being better by 30% over docetaxel. I think that's going to be a hard bar to reach, but that trial will be done. So I think that this sequencing is correct. The bigger issue, I think, is going to be when abiraterone gets introduced, where that fits into the treatment paradigm. Will that split the treatment of docetaxel from cabazitaxel, or will people tend more to treat people from docetaxel to cabazitaxel than to abiraterone? But I don't think there's any justification at this point in time to start patients with cabazitaxel as initial chemotherapy.
Andy, I'm kind of curious what it's been like taking care of this man. You know, we wish we could cure people like this, but it sounds like you've really achieved something humanly important with him. How do you feel about what's happened with him?
It's been a real battle over the years, some of which has been very disappointing. You know, we have a lot of these promising trials and systemic agents, that some of which they don't work for every man. And it's important to just keep in mind the next step and the next step as you're treating some of these men.
What's his state of mind right now?
I think he's scared to death. I mean, his father died in his 70s of prostate cancer. He tried to be as proactive as he could. You know, I think he's thinking of the next step, and obviously so are we.
What are you thinking? And maybe we can throw this out to the faculty. What might be the next step, Oliver, for a patient like this? If he came to you as a second opinion, do you have anything exciting in terms of research?
Well, you know, we really haven't talked about it, but the abiraterone is just probably about to be here. Actually, I'm one of the guys who'll have one of the compassionate use sites, and I'm thinking I'm going to have it either next week or the week after. So he's never seen abiraterone. Yes, he was treated with prior ketoconazole, didn't do a lot. But, you know, so long as he's sort of tolerating the cabazitaxel, I'd probably keep him on it, responding, of course. But I'd think about that abiraterone, compassionate use, as a potential next step.
That's really fascinating. We were going to talk about that later, but as long as you brought that up, I don't know, Steve, you know, this was, I guess, just reported in the ESMO meetings in Europe, Milan. Looks like it's helpful, Steve. Any thoughts about where that's heading?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very exciting that you have a drug that's taking testosterone down to zero and you see tremendous responses. I mean, the hazard rate for death is 0.65. We haven't seen anything like that in late stage disease. And as a urologist who focuses on earlier stage disease, it gets me going. This is studied post-Taxotere. That's going to be the FDA-approved label. But where is it going to fit in ultimately in clinical practice?
So suppose this man, you know, PSA starts going up, he gets back the same pain he had before. If abiraterone were available, would you be thinking about it for him?
After the cabazitaxel, absolutely. The question is, going retrospectively, would I have treated him much earlier with this drug if it were available? And the answer is probably yes. The question is exactly when, we don't know.
So Phil, this man comes to see you, and let's say it's 6 months or hopefully, you know, 5 years for now, but unfortunately, you know, it's probably not going to be very long before he's going to need another treatment. Beyond abiraterone, anything you're looking at, anything you've heard about that might be interesting to think about for somebody like this?
What I'm excited about right now is a new drug called XL184, which is a VEGFR2 c-MET inhibitor, which I think a lot of people on this panel have seen the results of. So a man with metastatic disease of the bone who's having pain in bone.
So TKI?
It's a TKI, small molecule inhibitor. It's oral. The side effects are not that dissimilar from Sutent, but it's absolutely spectacular with regard to bone scan response, with the vast majority of patients having major bone scan response. It's still in phase 2 studies, but we've treated a lot of patients, and the results have been spectacular.
And, you know, of course, what's most important is that the patients are improving, but, you know, we're hearing a lot about c-MET. I don't even, you know, is that downstream, upstream? You know, it's a thing we're hearing about in oncology. Any thoughts about why the drug is working? Is it the c-MET or the VEGF or both?
It could be one, both, or neither. And there are other kinases that are inhibited, but it's interesting that with androgen deprivation, c-MET expression goes up, and with VEGF inhibition, c-MET goes up. So the combination does make some sense, but we don't really know what the mechanism is. We don't know what the mechanism of activity in the bone, which is really spectacular. I mean, these patients that we've treated, many of the people on the panel, within a very short period of time, their bone scans either normalize completely or bone scans improve dramatically, and there is a pain correlation with it. What's puzzling, once again, Dan, is the PSAs don't necessarily go down. Some people will have soft tissue responses, not as dramatic as the bone scan responses, but it is a very impressive drug, and we're just beginning to sort out exactly how it's working and where it's going to fit in.
So that really is fascinating, but let me just bring something back to you, Dan. Let's say he can't travel or he's not eligible for study. Here are some papers looking at docetaxel retreatment. Would that be a consideration, and when do you use it, and does it help?
Yeah, you know, Neil, I think it's an important concept to get out there. You know, we've done this for a long time, really off protocol, before we had a drug like cabazitaxel, and we had a patient that had a prior exposure to docetaxel, and then some period of delay in between with other treatments. We've gone back to docetaxel in that setting. What's a little bit different about this case is now he's had docetaxel and he's had cabazitaxel. So the likelihood of after cabazitaxel going back to docetaxel and getting a response probably more like third-line treatment rather than thinking of it as docetaxel retreatment. So in general, our experience is a little bit of a diminishing return.
What would be an ideal clinical situation to try docetaxel again, Dan? What kind of case? And then I'll ask Phil.
Yeah, so, you know, I think this is where we have a little bit of flexibility in our practice. If we have somebody who has an excellent response to docetaxel therapy, has a long treatment break in between, you know, that's a patient you could re-challenge with docetaxel, or you could treat with cabazitaxel. So I think, you know, you have sort of a dealer's choice in a situation like that. Our clinical data, our level one evidence, is really with cabazitaxel, not with retreatment with docetaxel. So that's probably what I'm going to do in my practice. But I think that would be a scenario where you could consider it.
Phil, did you have a...
Yeah, I just wanted to... I learned the trick from William a number of years ago, and that was re-challenging patients with docetaxel but adding a low dose of carboplatin to it at an AUC of 4. William, do you want to talk about that combination?
Yeah, we did several prospective studies looking at the addition of carboplatin to docetaxel, and including in patients who were resistant to docetaxel, and we saw some additive synergy. So I think there's a subset of patients who are platinum sensitive. We're actually doing a clinical trial right now at Mount Sinai to see if we can identify markers of platinum sensitivity. And ultimately, you know, this is what we're doing in all of prostate cancers, trying to identify and break down the subsets of cancers that may respond to specific therapies, including traditional cytotoxic therapy. I don't think we really understand those subsets very well.
So before I ask Oliver about PARP inhibitors, because, you know, you got to ask about PARP inhibitors in any tumor. Before you do, Andy, any questions for the faculty?
No, he was just a good example of somebody who had had prior chemotherapy where you could still get immunotherapy in. And, you know, he had an outstanding response following immunotherapy to chemotherapy. And there's been some suggestion that the response of cytotoxic therapies following immunotherapy may be accentuated. We don't really understand how drugs like Sapulis LT work. The differentiation in the survival curve seems to occur when you're initiating chemotherapy. And I just wonder if the panelists could comment on their experience with chemotherapy responses after immunotherapy.
Dan?
Yeah, you know, I don't think anecdotally I got enough experience to really differentiate that yet. What I can tell you is that we certainly don't see any detriment with that. And, you know, on study, about half the patients went on to get docetaxel who had been chemo-naive. So there's some experience with that, and it does look like there is certainly a survival trend associated with that docetaxel treatment.
So before we go on to the next case, of course, I got to ask about PARP inhibitors. As soon as he said platinums, I'm like, what about it? How about it, Oliver? Anything in prostate cancer?
You know, it's right at sort of the edge. We don't have enough data to make any comments. And I was so enthusiastic until that last breast trial got reported and still kind of shaking my head. I mean, when I saw Joyce O'Shaughnessy's data, you know, when it first came out, I was just like, wow. And, you know, now I'm not even sure what to think. But I think it needs to be explored. And there is a subset of these patients that will have the BRCA mutations. And that might be the subset where we really need to look at it.
So prostate cancer with BRCA mutations... Maybe. Well, is that being looked at with PARP inhibitors?
No. There's actually a trial that's ongoing now, and I think it's a really good concept. I actually proposed it myself, but somebody beat me to it. But on the other hand, until we have the data, I just don't know.
So, William, you know, we did a lung cancer conference last weekend, and everybody's like, oh, God, the O'Shaughnessy paper, you know, because everybody heard about this press release. But we had a breast cancer think tank a couple weeks ago, and these people were like, just hold on a second. Let's wait till ASCO. Let's see the data, because there were, like, co-primary endpoints and all this other stuff. So I wouldn't, like, drop that right now.
Yeah, I agree completely. The devil's going to be in the details and the patient selection issues. But really, to Oliver's point, as many of you know, germline BRCA mutations are extremely rare in prostate cancer. That's not what we're really thinking about. We're really thinking about somatic mutations that really affect the BRCA pathway. And this concept has been coined BRCA-ness or BRCA-ness. And we've seen that ovarian cancer patients who are not germline BRCA1 or 2 carriers actually may have responses similar to this if they have a downstream alteration in the BRCA pathway. And we're looking at this in prostate cancer in a study that we're doing. We're actually biopsying the men, looking to see if they have a signature for BRCA-ness and seeing if that predicts responsiveness to platinum. And we think later that might be a signature for PARP inhibitors.
Yeah, at ASCO, I think there was like a 25% response rate in non-BRCA ovarian cancer, which was shocking. And then at San Antonio at the breast cancer symposium, and I don't know if you're looking at this too, they talked about, I think, hypermethylation, post-translational, blocking the BRCA pathway. Is that
right?
What you're...
That's one of the somatic ways in which you shut down the BRCA pathway is by methylating. And so that's not germline. They're not born with it. The tumor creates this aberration.
So, man, Jess, let's talk about your 56-year-old man with a prior history of Gleason 10 disease who then developed metastases that were treated with endocrine therapy, samarium, and docetaxel. Can you talk about the unusual way he recently presented?
What happened recently, within the last 2 weeks, he comes in with a headache and an examination. I mean, he was pointing to a particular place, and we found he has a swelling in the occipital area. So we did an MRI. MRI clearly shows a big skeletal lesion, skull lesion with bony destruction going into the parenchyma. It's a huge, probably about 6 to 7 centimeters in size.
He had neurologic symptoms or signs?
His main complaint more than pain was diplopia. And we were not able to explain. It's very interesting. We're not able to explain why he was having diplopia. We decided to go back and look at the MRI, and we found a bony lesion in the orbit on the left eye, which was limiting his lateral rectus movement.
So this wasn't a cranial nerve thing?
No.
This was direct?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah,
amazing.
Direct bony lesion. That was found only when we were looking. It's something going on locally.
Any of you on the faculty ever see this? I mean, I've heard of cranial nerve. You've seen it, Phil?
Yeah, orbital mets causing a sick nerve palsy, the eye.
So you got radiation therapy, I'm
sure. Yeah, the reason we went back and looked at the MRI is because of prostate cancer going to the brain. He's heard of, but it's not as common. So that's the reason we reviewed. And within about 3-4 treatments, he's doing well.
Did the mass shrink down with the radiation?
We don't have any update anymore. I got to go back and...
But clinically,
clinically, he has done well. Pain is better. He's moving around now independently, so he's back to his day-to-day activities, of course, not to his work. But the question now is, he wants to be treated. You know, he's always very positive in his attitude.
So do
I go back to docetaxel? Of course, he's getting better with his blood counts.
How long has it been since he got the docetaxel the first time?
It was stopped in August of 2010, so it's a few months now.
Okay, so Phil, what might you be thinking about this man's next systemic therapy? Mm.
So the question I ask is, did he respond to the docetaxel?
Yes, he responded very well.
And
really
he was still
stopped.
In response. Was his PSA
yes,
still going
yes.
down or low?
Absolutely.
Then
yeah.
I wouldn't hesitate to restart him on docetaxel again as my first intervention. I might use the William trick and add carboplatin here. You know, there's no hesitation on my part to initiate chemotherapy here. I don't think you can rely on a bisphosphonate or a denosumab, or I think it's chemotherapy, and a chemotherapy that's going to work as soon as possible. If there's any hint that he was refractory to the docetaxel, then I go right to capacitaxel.
Dan?
Yeah, I just respectfully like to disagree
All right.
with my
Good, I like
mentor
that.
Here. Because I don't think you need much more evidence of disease progression than this, you know, nasty bone lesion within a few months' time growing, you know, right into this eye, in addition to the, you know, diffuse bony pain he's having. So, in general, if you look at the cabazitaxel trial, the time
This is a 6-month interval, though, right?
It stopped in August of end of August 2010.
Six month interval.
But this didn't grow overnight, Phil. So this has been going on. Now it's gotten to the point where he's clinically symptomatic from it, but clearly you know, there was growth going on here. So he could respond partially to docetaxel. He's probably not going to get a dramatic long response. And my concern with the samarium, the radiation, now a second radiation, going back to docetaxel chemotherapy, how much marrow will he be able to take to get through a full course of cabazitaxel after that? So in somebody like this, I'd probably be moving on to cabazitaxel, knowing it's, in terms of sensitivity, docetaxel, cabazitaxel are related enough that I would expect it to be reasonably tolerated, rather than adding in a kind of unproven regimen, no offense, William, of docetaxel and carboplatin, and potentially never getting to or not tolerating well that cabazitaxel regimen.
The main issue is rechallenging it with docetaxel, 6-month interval since he last received it, and he responded to it, showed no signs of resistance at that time.
A lot of complications.
But the flip side of that is that if you're worried about a post-samarium patient with myelosuppression, that although we don't have direct head-to-head comparison, you know, cabazitaxel, you know, that's the major side effect. So in the end, I think the real question, I always view this way, which is, how can you get the most out of all of the therapies for the patient? And in my mind, I think this is similar to a lot of people who re-challenge with docetaxel is, you know, has he gotten everything from docetaxel that he can? And is this the time to re-challenge, or is this the time to switch therapies? But I don't consider him a progressor on docetaxel because he's been off of treatment for so
Incidentally,
long.
Incidentally, would you wait until the radiation therapy is done? And how long after the radiation would you start chemo, William?
I personally would wait a month. And sometimes if I'm concerned about myelosuppression, I might start with weekly docetaxel. I've done this in the setting of not wanting to follow, let's say, you know, radiation to the pelvis. To the skull, I wouldn't worry as much, and I try to give a month interval.
Phil, here's some data looking at the issue of symptom improvement with chemotherapy. I think people tend to think about chemotherapy as causing symptoms. We actually asked oncologists, when you start patients on chemo, we use docetaxel because this is October, what do you tell them to expect in terms of quality of life in a symptomatic patient? And actually, the oncologist said most of the time they say that we expect it actually to improve on chemotherapy. Phil, what's your experience with quality of life with chemo in patients who you're balancing out relief of symptoms versus toxicity of the treatment?
Yeah, I'm treating symptomatic patients, not asymptomatic patients. So what happens is they either improve or they don't. They don't get worse. So that's my general experience. I think about 50% of people will benefit from it with a reduction in pain, and about a third will not benefit from it.
You know, one of the things here that we sometimes forget about, so if you actually look at the pain responses in the randomized trial, weekly taxanes can give some symptomatic relief as well. Here's a guy, you know, he's got this radiation, he's got this samarium, and, you know, he's kind of benefit, but I'm really worried about his marrow reserve. I might even consider starting off with a little bit of kind of weekly taxane, though that may not be very conventional.
Which weekly taxane?
I don't know how to do weekly cabazitaxel yet, but I might just go back with a little docetaxel and, you know, just try to transition this guy into something. This guy needs some treatment really soon. I can't leave him alone very long.
All right. There's no substitute to watching this patient, obviously, very, very closely, treating him with something, close follow-up, and changing if necessary.
Okay, let's move on to Dr. Glenn in Massachusetts via Skype. Phil, can you tell us about your 67-year-old man with metastatic disease on endocrine treatment, and specifically what happened with his spine?
So the patient had been on nilotamide for about 8 months, and his PSA had been stable between 30 and 40. And he came in for a routine visit in August and said, well, I've had some more pain. It's been more pronounced in the middle of my back in the last day or two. He was fully ambulatory, but the pain was something that this is a fellow that would readily minimize any discomfort at all. He really finds it a nuisance that he has prostate cancer. And because of that, we got an MRI of his spine. He had previously had bone scans on a couple of occasions when he had rises in PSAs to assess where he had been at, but he had never had an MRI. And when we obtained the MRI, it was dramatic. He had involvement of the thoracic spine from T7 through T10 with involvement of the vertebral body, the pedicle, the spinous process. And from the time he left my office to the time he went to the hospital, he was getting noticeably weaker. I called neurosurgeon, radiation therapy, started him on steroids right away. And when the neurosurgeon came in and reviewed the films, we talked on the phone, and then in preparing for this meeting, we talked again, and he said, I don't know if I've ever seen anything like this where there was really nothing that I could readily stabilize this thoracic spine with without doing a huge procedure of putting in stabilizing rods. He felt that anything he would do would just telescope down. Subsequently, he received radiation therapy and steroids, and fortunately, with rehab, he's gotten better. He is ambulatory. He's not back cycling by any means. I mean, I can't imagine he's ever going to get back to that. But literally over the course of a week, he went from cycling and playing golf to initially walking with a walker. Now he's walking independently. And he's back in the treatment mode and is on an early phase trial of a c-MET VEGF inhibitor.
So, William, you know, when we chatted about this, Phil talked about the feeling in the pit of his stomach when the man started to lose, you know, control of his legs. And I guess, Phil, sort of thinking back, did he have any pain or anything ahead of time that may, you know, you verbalized to me, yeah, you know, maybe I should have done the MRI earlier.
Yeah, and actually, I really like the guy. He's a good guy, and we've had very, very candid conversations. And even today we had a conversation. He said, you know, really, I think there's pain that I should have been more aware of or more sensitive to about a week before I had the visit. But prior to that, he had no pain. He was playing golf and actually riding the same cycling routes that the neurosurgeon rides.
So, William, it's sort of like Monday morning quarterbacking here, but no oncologist wants to see this happen. Any thoughts about what happened and what we can learn from this?
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, this is a pretty typical situation. First of all, spinal cord compression is relatively rare, even though many prostate cancer patients who are castrate-resistant have extensive bony mets. We still don't see a high percentage of patients actually develop cord compression. The other thing is that obviously we're dealing with a group of men, for example, in this case, who may minimize their symptoms, although he was really asymptomatic a week before. And we really don't understand the pathophysiology of what happens when somebody develops cord compression. In other words, you know, he may have had a growing lesion in his vertebra, and then at some point there's a collapse. And people have tried to look retrospectively at whether there are predictors of this. And the bottom line is there are no good predictors of who's actually going to have this type of symptom. So I think, you know, the problem is that until you actually hear the symptom, his PSA was stable, he was active, there was no reason that Phil would have wanted to do an MRI.
Phil, would you do an MRI in a patient like this?
In an asymptomatic patient with bone mets to his spine, I would not do an MRI. The two precipitants would be pain, which I was about to mention. Jim Talcott at our institution many years ago showed that almost always when you develop spinal cord compression, pain precedes it. So the onset of pain in the back would make me do an MRI. In the absence of pain, I would not have done an MRI in this man. But the other Phil Glynn, who's a good friend of mine, did mention that he did have pain in the week before, but didn't mention it to Phil. But in the absence of pain, I would not do an MRI.
How do you approach these patients in your own practice, Dan?
Yeah, you know, I think the key feature in this case was the chronicity. If someone's got back pain that's been going on for 10 years, it's stable, or maybe it comes and goes a little bit, but it's basically, you know, within a relatively stable range. You know, I'm very comfortable with patients, you know, having chronic back pain. What was different about this case was that this was new, and this gentleman wasn't necessarily appreciating the fact that this was an increasing symptom. But that's really the key symptom here. With spinal cord compression, this is one of our few medical emergencies in cancer, and it's true of every cancer that can cause this. This can literally change in a matter of hours. And I think, you know, Phil, this was a real example of that exactly happening. And it really is different than the kind of progression we might be used to seeing on scans with disease on therapy, you know, where progression may happen over the course of a few months. This is something, it's not necessarily growth of disease. This is largely an inflammatory process once it's in there. And that's what can change very quickly. So kind of recognizing the new onset of pain being different from just having pain. And that, to me, is really the trigger. Regardless of the intensity, it's a new onset.
So, Dan, what do you make of the sort of reported fluctuation in PSA rather than a steady incline in PSA? Is that surprising to you?
You know, I think this is going to be one of the really important things going forward in the field is, you know, over the last 10 years, we've seen a de-emphasis on PSA. When I first started in prostate cancer, really, we were managing solely around PSA in many cases. And I think now we've come to realize that PSA alone is really not the best measure for evaluating patients and really keeping a composite measure of scans, of other markers, and to follow this, and certainly symptoms to follow this disease. And I think one of the things we're going to need to do in the field better is to serially image our patients, particularly early on with castration-resistant prostate cancer, to pick up early metastatic disease, because now we've got something to do for patients with asymptomatic early metastatic disease where in the past that wouldn't necessarily have changed our practice.
So final point from Oliver, there was a classic study where they managed to randomize patients between surgery and radiation therapy in patients with cord compression, patients with various types of tumors. Everybody always refers to the fact that in this study, patients did better with surgery. Oliver, what's your approach in general? It looks like in this case, they really couldn't do surgery, but is that your usual first option in these situations?
You know, I often consult the neurosurgeon on these, and a lot of it depends on the context. This guy with a relatively isolated degree of skeletal involvement, then with cord compression, is not my usual experience. Usually we have guys with, you know, 59 tumors up and down the spine, and we have this area of increasing pain. We get the MRI, and we, like Dan, you know, with these change in symptoms.
That's what I was talking about, early imaging.
And so it's change in symptoms that are the kind of things. And then you start doing your physical exam and you ask the guy. So the bottom line is I'll very often get a neurosurgical consult. Sometimes these guys are candidates, sometimes they're not. So it really depends on the context of the patient, how they're doing overall and the extent of their lesions.
Real quick, Phil, any questions for the faculty after hearing this discussion?
No, not really. The interesting point about the PSA that Phil made there, this PSA, when he came in, he hadn't had his labs, and so we got some labs, and he was sent over to the hospital. His PSA had gone from low 40s to 80 over the course of what was just going to be a routine visit. So I think that there was just an acceleration in his process.
So let's go back to Eric. And as soon as he started out talking about a case that began, I had this 90-year-old patient. I was like, yeah, we're presenting this person. So it's, yeah, there are really a lot of patients in clinical practice over age 80, 85, 90, and so vexing as to what to do. Eric, again, without going into the whole details, can you talk about sort of how this 90-year-old man is functioning right now and, you know, what his situation is? And I know you had asked me, well, maybe we can bounce off the faculty. Would you use chemo in a 90-year-old? Can you kind of talk about where he's at right now?
Yeah, Dr. Love, this is the kind of patient that you want to do everything for. He's, believe it or not, a veteran of World War II, Korea, and Vietnam, and has never once complained to me about anything in my clinic. So his slowly but surely, his PSA has gone up, and he has gone through this process through many doctors, Army doctors who've come and gone of intermittent anti-androgen therapy and has been on leuprolide pretty much the whole time. But his PSA is clearly rising now. And the question is, would you consider Cyplucel-T in somebody this age? He's asymptomatic. His only criteria for any treatment that he receives from me is that it not make him feel bad.
What's his lifestyle like?
He's a PS1. He's active. He uses a cane, but he says he only uses it because his wife makes him. Otherwise, he gardens. He's a pretty active guy.
Now, does he have symptoms from the meds?
No.
So, Phil, how about treatment?
So, 90 is the new 85. Okay. I would not do anything until this patient became symptomatic. I would hold off.
Why wouldn't you give him Cyplucel-T?
He's asymptomatic. I would wait until he became symptomatic before doing anything, and I would pick simple interventions at the time that I needed to do something.
So, and you're basing that purely on his age?
No, not his age. He's asymptomatic.
Yeah, but isn't that where you use Cyplucel-T? He's got asymptomatic meds.
You know, I'd be hesitant about doing anything in this man at this point in time. I would wait until he had some evidence of progression of symptomatology.
Again,
whether it be Cyplucel-T, whether it be secondary hormonal therapies, chemotherapy, I would observe the guy, reassure him, and see him on a regular basis.
Dan, agree, disagree, or in between? 90.
Let's see, I've disagreed twice with Phil so far tonight. I don't know if I can push my envelope here.
I didn't teach him well enough.
I would say this. I mean, you can't necessarily put an age limit on something like this. I mean, this is a gentleman, he's had the disease for 17 years. He's going to live several years more in all likelihood. But people who live well with reasonably good performance status to age 90, if you actually look, those patients have a fairly high likelihood to live to 94, 95. I mean, I think it was like a 60, 70% chance. So,
William, I hesitate to even say this after what Phil said, but any situation where you use chemo,
yes,
you can see we asked the audience, what's the oldest patient you've given chemo to? It looks like it's early 80s, but you tell me.
96.
96.
So,
there you go.
Let me just tell you the story. So this is a gentleman
96?
Who was still working. He was
96.
Still working, lived by himself. A delightful man. And his daughter was a PhD, worked for the federal government. When his cancer was starting to progress, he was becoming minimally symptomatic. We started ketoconazole. He took one pill. It ruined a trip to the Cape. And then he was admitted. About 2 months later, he was admitted to the hospital, very symptomatic, and we started him on weekly dose of Taxol. You want to hear the punchline? Okay, we started him on lower dose, weekly dose of Taxol. About 6 months later, he wanted to watch his grandson get married in Chicago, and he danced at that wedding. And I think the point is that by itself, age is not a contraindication to therapy. I mean, we made a lot of accommodations for his age. We gave him lower dose chemo. In fact, I'd see him every week alternating with my NP, and I'd ask him if the chemo bothered him. It was not the chemo. It was only when the cancer progressed. And he lived a total of a year after we started chemo. So that's
amazing.
My story.
So let's go back to Eric, and then we're going to try to quickly present the last case. But I've got to see what Eric thinks about this discussion in terms of his patient and how he thinks maybe hearing all this discussion, he might. What are you thinking, Eric?
You know, it's going to be one of those discussions I have with the patient. I think I will observe him for a while longer. You know, and see, of course, you get nervous as the PSA continues to double. He's still in the low double digits now, so I think I have a little bit of time.
Any way you could see giving him chemo at any point?
No, I don't think so.
Is it because of the age, the number, or the way he looks, or what are you thinking?
It's because he does not want anything that might make him feel bad, and chemo is a dirty word to he and his wife.
So probably not. I'm curious how abiraterone is tolerated by patients.
That's an interesting thought. Dan, what about abiraterone in this man, if it becomes available?
You know, I think that this is the kind of situation where I think you might want to use that drug a little bit earlier rather than later, especially in a patient that, you know, is relatively minimal symptomatic. I mean, this is somebody who, you know, could likely tolerate abiraterone well, even though he is elderly. We certainly do need to watch electrolytes in these folks and, you know, be careful around fluid status, hypertension, and that sort of thing.
Does he have hypertension or heart failure or anything, Eric?
Well-controlled hypertension. No heart failure.
Is there a way to get abiraterone now, like compassionate use or anything?
There is, yeah.
But it's only post-docetaxel.
Post-docetaxel.
Yeah, because the Cougar 301 reported out post-docetaxel only. See,
so or if
this,
you're over,
this
or
guy,
if you're
maybe
over
there's
90.
Some clinical trial.
Or, 90. Or if you're over 90.
This concludes our program. To obtain a certificate of completion and receive credit for this activity, please complete the post-test, fill out the educational assessment and credit form, and fax both to 919-401-1213 or mail both to Duke University School of Medicine, Center for Educational Excellence, Duke CME, DCRI, 300 West Morgan Street, Suite 800, Box 104785, Durham, North Carolina, 27701. You may also complete the post-test and education assessment online at www.researchtopractice.com/GUCancers. Special thanks to our faculty and presenting oncologist, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for this special highlights program of a CME meeting held at the GU Symposium in Orlando.